Okay, we Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, page 1046. Parshas Ki Tzeitzei is a very, very action-packed parsha. It's one of these parshas in the Torah that are just packed with mitzvahs. Just to give you a little bit of an insight, there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. In Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, there are 27 positive mitzvahs and 47 negative mitzvahs. So what's that? What is the 67? 74. 74 mitzvahs out of the 613. That's a pretty high percentage, right? And it's a range of different mitzvahs. We've got all kinds of mitzvahs. We've got a mitzvah, the first mitzvah of the woman, you know, you see in war. Mitzvahs of kilayim, not mixing seeds, not mixing wool and linen, not mixing animals together, and so on and so forth. Lots of different mitzvahs to do with marriage, divorce, some forbidden relationships, yibum, levirate marriage, all different kinds of mitzvahs. A lot of things to do with employment, with returning lost articles, sending away the mother bird. All of these mitzvahs, it's really a very, very action-packed parasha. It also has, like all these parashas do, a connection to the month of Elul, which we're not going to go into too much today. Just in the very beginning of the parasha, we have the famous, we've done this before, the mitzvah of the woman that a soldier encounters in war and brings to his house, and says there, she will cry for her parents for a month, 30 days. The Mefarshim say the 30 days refers to the month of Elul, and so on and so forth. Okay. But I'm not going to, today what I want to do is not take the part we've done already, because we've done lots of these different mitzvahs before. But what I want to do is briefly look into one of the mitzvahs and then share with you a concept that's got to do with the second part of the parsha. The two are completely unrelated. So in a sense, it's just the shiur is in two parts. Look at one aspect and then develop an idea with regard to another aspect. So part one is the mitzvah of making a fence around the roof. It's on page 1050, 1050. And it's the mitzvah of Micah, the mitzvah of making a fence. Let's have a look at the pasuk. It's page 1050, pasuk Ches, verse 8. One pasuk, the pasuk says, "Ki sivne bayis chodosh." When you build a new house, ve'asisa maike legagecha, and you should make a fence around your roof. Why? Ve'lo sasim domim beveisecha, so that you won't spill blood in your house. In other words, if you don't do that, then someone's going to fall off the roof. Chas v'shalom. Ki yipoil hanoifel. Because if you don't do it, the one who's destined to fall will fall off your roof. I say the word destined to fall because there's a famous problem here with the wording. It says, Ki yipoil hanoifel mimenu. The faller will fall off the roof. Which is a strange expression because, of course, the faller is not a faller until he falls off, right? it should say the person who is... A person will fall off the roof, not the faller will fall off the roof. Someone will fall off the roof, right? But I think we've done this before, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but there's a whole philosophical explanation that at the end of the day, Rashi points out that if someone falls off your roof, they were destined to fall off the roof. Otherwise, they were going to fall off anyway. But nevertheless, the Torah says, you need to protect your roof, you need to make a fence around your roof, because what will happen to that person is not related to you. You need to make sure that negative things don't happen through you. Hashem will find a way for things to happen to people that it's destined to happen to, but it doesn't have to be through you, and therefore you need to protect your roof. And essentially, by extension, there's the mitzvah that obligates us to be safe, to make sure that everything in our house is safe, to make sure that we don't... The same thing, putting a fence around a pool, not leaving sharp or dangerous objects around, would all be included in this mitzvah. Again, we're page 1050, 1050, verse 8. We're doing it in two parts. This look at something in the parasha and then look at something else. So I want to just share with you a few interesting things with regard to this particular mitzvah, more on the spiritual level. And again, we're going to do this both times today. Based on the principle we've spoken about many, many times, that the mitzvahs are given to us on many levels. And even when we're not in a situation to observe the mitzvah in a literal sense, but every mitzvah has a lot of different lessons and applications on various different levels. So particularly with this mitzvah also, we find that this mitzvah, on the literal sense, on the halachic level, is talking about creating physical fences around dangerous objects or dangerous places, like building a fence around the roof and so on and so forth. But also the mefarshim, the commentaries, speak a lot about how this mitzvah is about not only physical protection, but it's about spiritual protection. And I'm just going to share with you three ideas that come from this, that from various different commentaries. The first comes from the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer says a very interesting thing. He says, this mitzvah is really alluding, it's talking about the concept of creating fences around mitzvah observance. We know this idea in the Torah that says in the first Mishnah of the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, it says that one of the things that were taught to us by the very first disciples of the Minhag Great Assembly is to be calm in judgment, is to have many disciples, and also Vasu Siyag La Torah, create a fence around the Torah. So if you know that you're tempted to do something wrong, what you do is you create a precautionary measure, a stringent measure around that problem so that you're kept away from it. Just like, it's like a protective fence, right? Which is the idea of some of the rabbinic decrees that we have there. For example, the rabbinic decrees we have around Shabbos, right? So for example, on Shabbos, you're not supposed to write, but also biblically, you're not allowed, one of the 39 prohibited activities. But we're also not allowed to touch a pen or move a pen. Now, moving a pen is not a biblical prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition, but it's a fence. In other words, one of the reasons is because if you touch things you're not supposed to use, then you'll lose consciousness and you will end up for writing. So therefore they say, don't write the pen, right? And then there's things that people do on their own. There's sort of our own individual fences that we make. If someone knows that they particularly tempted with a certain transgression, they create fences around that transgression so they won't actually come anywhere near the transgression. But the Chassam Sofer says that the Pasuk is warning us that one has to do that within a certain balance. Sometimes what a person can do is they can overwhelm him or herself with so many fences, with so many stringencies, that it can actually become counterproductive and actually be destructive. And he says, this is what the Pasuk means. Again, he reads the Pasuk on a deeper level. He says, Kisivne bayis chodesh, when you encounter a new house, a new experience, right? Vesissa maika legagecha, you shall make a fence around your roof. In other words, that's the idea of stringencies, precautionary measures, and so on and so forth. But veloisosim domim beveisecha, but don't spill blood in your house. In other words, don't be destructive. Don't do it to a point where it becomes destructive rather than being constructive. Because what is very, very common to happen, he says, ki yipol hanoifel mimenu, the faller will fall down. In other words, you just end up falling down. When you create commitments that are unrealistic to keep, when you create fences around your own roof that are just overwhelming and too strict, that are impossible to keep, you set yourself up for failure. So therefore the Torah says we need to build fences, we need to grow, we need to create those commitments, but we need to do it in a way where it's realistic. And I suppose that's really also very much connected with this time of the year. It's not only about fences, it's about general resolutions. You know, Rosh Hashanah, of course, we've spoken about this many times. This month of Elul and coming to Rosh Hashanah is a time where every person really needs to move, we need to grow, we need to shift. That's the idea of this time of the year. We need to actually bring some improvement, solid improvement into our lives, and actually take upon ourselves things which we haven't done before and grow in ways that we haven't done before, and that's part of the whole culture this month. But at the same time, we have to set ourselves up for success. We have to not take, sometimes resolutions fall down because they're unrealistic. We just overcommit. But the idea behind it is actually to take solid resolutions, but at the same time, things that can work. And that's what the Chassam Sofer says is the deeper meaning of this pasuk. That's one idea. And I'm just sharing you three ideas in this particular mitzvah. Second idea is in one of the talks of the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he says the following. He says that this is a pasuk warning a person to protect himself from his own ego. It says, when you build a new house, in other words, when you grow, when you rise, when people grow, often what happens is there's a huge trap. The trap is that one can feel so good about one's own achievements, which is not a bad thing, but one can do it in a way where you start to become egocentric. So therefore it says, when you build a new house, when you encounter a new experience, when you encounter new success, even spiritually, there are sisa maika legagecha. You need to make a fence around that roof. What is the roof? The roof represents ego. The roof is the highest point of the building. That highness of the building represents the ego problem that a person can have. So a person needs to make a fence and contain that ego and make sure it doesn't become destructive. And then he continues and he says, that actually is not his idea, that comes from the great Shalom, one of the great Kabbalists. But he says, the problem is that it doesn't follow then in the Pasuk, because it says if you don't do that, then someone's going to fall off your roof. Right? Now, if we translate a Pasuk to mean something else in a deeper or a different spiritual application, then, and we say that's the mitzvah on a different layer, on a different level, then it's got to make sense. The whole thing has to make sense. So he asks the question, he says, when the mitzvah is applied on its literal level, that I've got to have a roof in my house and I've got to build a fence, then the whole pasuk makes sense, the whole verse makes sense. When you have a new house, we're talking about flat roofs, right? Build a fence around your roof so that someone else shouldn't climb up and fall over. We understand that. But when we talk about its spiritual application, this is a warning to build a fence around my own ego, then it should be more about me falling. In other words, build a fence around your own ego, because if you don't, you will fall. But that's not what the pasuk says. The pasuk says, build a fence around your own ego, because otherwise someone else is going to fall off your ego. Someone else is going to fall off your roof. So how does that work? So he says, very simple. He says, this is a lesson, a particular instruction that the Torah gives, specifically directed to people in any position of leadership. That when a person, particularly in a situation of leadership, falls into the trap of ego, the damage is not only to the person who has the ego. The damage is to the person that he or she leads. Because when you communicate to people, when you instruct people, when you inspire or influence people in the context of ego, it doesn't work. It's never sincere, and it's not effective, and on the contrary, it does damage. And that's what the Pasuk is saying. When you build a new house, when you encounter an experience of a new career, a new experience, you enter into a situation of leadership, build a fence around your roof. Build a fence around your ego. Because if not, not only will you fall down, not only will you be damaged, but the faller off will fall off. In other words, someone else will fall. You will damage others, and therefore this emphasizes the importance of containing an ego and creating a fence around one's own ego. And we know this is such, I know we talk about this a lot lately, but it's a truth, it's a very, very important thing, because the more a person, the test of ego is a very, very hard test, particularly when the more successful you are, the more leadership a person is. It's actually much easier to be humble if you don't do anything. But then it's fine, you know. But the more a person leads, the more a person, any type of leadership, whether it's small or big, the more a person gets into a position of leadership, the more probable or the more dangerous it is to fall into the trap of ego. And that's exactly what the pasuk is saying. That's the spiritual application of this pasuk. And he's saying, when you go into that experience, build that fence around the ego so that it doesn't become ineffective and doesn't become destructive, not only for you, but for the people you lead as well. And a third concept I wanted to share with you on this particular mitzvah, and then we're going to go to a different part of the parasha, is a beautiful thought, a very innovative thought from the Ben Ish Chai. I've quoted him before. The Ben Ish Chai was a great Sephardic leader who passed away in 1902. He was the rabbi of the Iraq community in Iraq. He was the accepted leader of the Iraqi Jewry at the time. He was a very, very great Sephardic leader. And he says the following, and it's a very, he comes up with really innovative thoughts. He's a great tzaddik, he was a great thinker. He wrote many, many books. And he says the following. He says it based on an interesting thing. He says, again, also following the same line, that this mitzvah is an instruction for spiritual protection. He says, it's interesting that in the tefillin, right? Men have a mitzvah to put on tefillin every day. In the tefillin, I think I've showed this before, in the tefillin, the head tefillin has a shin, the letter shin engraved on it or carved out on it on either side, right? You wear that. The shin is like a symbol of tefillin and mezuzah and things like that. But with tefillin, there's a very interesting law, halacha, that tefillin, the shin normally has three legs. With the tefillin, one of the shins on one of the sides has four legs. Did you know that? Yeah. It's a very interesting thing. It looks like a shin from far. You wouldn't, you know, unless you really concentrate, you wouldn't tell the difference. But it's actually not a shin. It's a shin with an extra leg. So it's three legs, a regular, right? Three legs on the one side, four legs on the end. So he says the following. What's the difference between the shin of three and the shin of four? So he says, the shin of four represents learning. Learning. Study. Why? Because Torah study is normally, we know, is divided into four parts. There's the concept of the orchard of Torah. Have I shared that with you? That we know that there's four layers of every concept in Torah. Within every layer, there's many layers, but there's four layers of every concept in Torah. There's the pshat, the literal meaning. There's the drush, the midrashic meaning, which means the non-literal meaning. There's the remez. Remez means hints, what it alludes to. Things that it alludes to which aren't directly connected. And then there's the sod, which means secret, which is the esoteric meaning. Right? And that's a famous idea. And it makes up the word paradise. Paradise is an orchard. That's the orchard of Torah. So learning, you want to categorize learning into four. And we can learn anything in Torah on four levels. And they're all true. Right? This is a mistake some people have. Like they say, Medrash, is it true? Is the story in the Medrash true? It's the wrong question. The story is not if it's true. If it's it might not be literal, but of course it's true. If it's part of Torah, it's true. In other words, it's a legitimate, true interpretation of Torah. It doesn't mean that the story is literal, if it's a Medrash, right? You know what I'm saying? So every part of Torah, Hashem gave us the Torah on four layers. When we learn Chumash, just learn Chumash, we're learning Pshat. We're learning literal meaning. We're trying to understand what is it saying. But if we learn Medrash, or we learn a deeper meaning, we're trying to understand the Midrash. We're learning things that it alludes to. In fact, I think what we're learning now in the Pasuk, it probably fits into Remez. In other words, it's not directly related. It's something that this Pasuk alludes to, right? And of course, Sod, there's the esoteric, the deeper, the Kabbalistic meaning of the Pasuk. That's four. Therefore, he says, the Shin of four represents learning, represents the concept of learning, right? He says, the Shin of three represents action. Behavior. Why? Because we know that the mitzvahs divide themselves into three parts. There's the Chukim, Mishpatim, and Edut. There's the chukim, mitzvahs that have no reason, which we do. There's the edut, mitzvahs which have a logical reason, but not a reason that we'd figure out on our own, like Pesach or Tefillin or Mezuzah. And then there's the mitzvahs which are purely rational, so much so that we could have kind of figured out most of the mitzvah, so to speak, if the Torah hadn't been given. Right? So therefore, that's the Torah's divide. So action is divided into three, learning is divided into four, and therefore he says that those are the two shins of the tefillin. The shin of three is action, the shin of four is learning. Now he says that the combination of the two things work really well. In other words, if someone wants to be spiritually protected, one without the other, action without learning actually doesn't last. Action without learning is beautiful. Every mitzvah person does is fantastic. But if you want to sustain action, you want to sustain behavior, you need to have both. You need to have the commitment of action, but you also need to have the internalization and the absorbing and the enthusiasm which comes from learning. Right? So the combination of both serves as a protection for the person. If one is able to do a mitzvah, but one doesn't have the learning, that person is vulnerable. That person is at risk of it not being protected spiritually. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the spiritual danger is much easier. It's much easier to target someone who has the one without the other, the one shin without the other shin, right? They're both fantastic, they're both beautiful, but you have to have them both. The commitment of action with the absorption and internalization of learning. So he says, if you have one without the other, then you need a real spiritual, then you need a real good protection. And he says, and this is what the Pasuk is telling us. Now listen to this, it's actually very innovative. Have a look at the word for one in Aramaic. In Hebrew, one is echad, right? But Aramaic, which are very similar words to Hebrew, the word for one is chad. Chad. Chad means one. So he says, ki sivne bayis chadosh. If you build a house, and again, the house is talking about our spiritual journey. Chadosh. Chadosh. But the problem with the house is, chadosh is broken into two words. It's chad shin. It's only one shin. You don't have the other shin. Then ve'asisa maika legagecha. You're going to have to build a fence around your roof. You have to have extra measure of protection because you're missing that protection of the combination between the two shins. And that's what he built into the class. A very, very, very creative thought. Now, I mentioned it because I'm also going to share with you something new that I learned this year, which is, I'm still using it probably for a shiur before Rosh Hashanah, but I'll since we're trying to tie everything into preparing and gearing ourselves up for Rosh Hashanah.
Sneak preview.
Sorry? Sneak preview, exactly. Now, and also, it's Elul. You know what I said about Elul the other day? I gave a shiur to someone about Elul, to a few people, but Elul. And I said that Elul is like this. The month of Elul is, it's the month of preparation of Rosh Hashanah. I mean, it's the most powerful month. Elul, I think, is, if you look into the Sfarim and you look into the whole idea of what Elul represents, the king in the field, God's accessibility, and so on and so forth, Elul is probably one of the most powerful things in the Jewish calendar, and one of the things that's easiest to miss. It's easiest to miss. Why? Because by definition, Elul is a regular month. There's no special days. It's just we go about our regular routine. And we need to really think about it and make sure we don't miss Elul. That's why I tried doing Elul to mixing things that have to do with Elul and Rosh Hashanah so we don't lose consciousness. So I'm going to share with you a thing which is really connected to this concept of the Ben Ish Chai that has to do with the apple and the honey. We spoke a lot about apple and honey over the last few years, but here's a new concept, one you haven't heard before, at least not from me. Because I just discovered it this year. Of why the apple and the honey? What is the apple? Why we eat apple and honey? Everyone knows apple and honey, sweet year. Of course, the problem is that apple's not really sweet, and honey, there's other sweet things that can have sugar, so why apple and honey, right? So many, many different things. I'm not going to go into the shiur now because we've done this before, but this is the new thing. So it says like this, apple also represents action. Why? Because the Talmud tells us that what is the fruit? Because apple's a fruit, right? It says the fruit of righteous people are their mitzvahs, or the things that they do. When we behave in a certain way, when we do things, when we produce things, that's what we produce. We produce mitzvahs. We do a favor for another person, we do a mitzvah, we put a mezuzah, we light candles. That's when we translate what's in ourselves into the world. That's what we produce, right? And that's fruit. So fruit represents action. Now the apple particularly represents the commitment to keeping mitzvahs, even at the level we don't understand anything. Because don't forget, there's value, there's something special about being committed to doing a mitzvah without understanding, without learning. Why? Because we all know the famous idea that when the Torah was given, and God asked the Jewish people if they accept the Torah, the Jews said the famous phrase. The famous phrase was, Nasiv Nishma, we will do and then we'll understand. Meaning we'll do even if we don't understand. Right? So the Gemara, when it discusses the giving of the Torah, says the following. It says, why the Jewish people compared to an apple? You know Jewish people are compared to an apple. It says in the Song of Songs, King Solomon says that we were born under the apple orchard. Because in Egypt, when the women gave birth, it was a whole miracle story. Bottom line is they gave birth under the apple orchards. The apple trees. Right? Then the angels came and whisked the babies away because they were under threat from Pharaoh. A whole story. So there's always a symbolism. That's why we use apples in the Charoses on Pesach as well. We were born under an apple tree. So often Jewish people are connected to an apple. Okay. So why we ask? So the Gemara says why are we connected to an apple? So the Gemara says like this because, and I don't know. I'm not a gardener. That's one of the things I tried a few times and didn't succeed at. So I've given it up. But apparently, I thought it'd be nice exercise or something, but it didn't work, right? But apparently, an apple tree is a tree. The Gemara says the tapuach tree, which is presumably an apple tree, is a tree that works differently to most trees, where the fruit buds, the fruit comes out before the leaves. All other trees don't do that, except for the apple tree, apparently. And therefore, says the Gemara, the same thing. Just like the apple tree, the fruit comes out before the rest of the tree, before the leaves, before the blossoms, so too the Jews committed themselves to action before anything else. Right? So that's an apple. Honey, on the other hand, is not commitment without understanding. Honey is understanding. That's what makes it sweet. Honey is when you taste something, when it's sweet, when you enjoy it. When can you enjoy something? When do you really taste the sweetness of something? When you understand it, when you relate to it. Right? So that's why honey represents learning, and that's why we find that the Torah is compared to honey. Torah study is compared to honey. Right? Now, why specifically honey? So like this. One of the incredible differences, the contrast between apple and honey, and have you ever thought about this? That an apple is a fruit, many fruit do this, but the apple particularly goes bad very quickly. It rots very quickly. You cut up an apple, you leave it 5 minutes out of the fridge, it goes brown. Right? We talk about a rotten apple. Why do we talk about it? People talk about a rotten apple? Always because an apple goes rotten very, very quickly. Apples don't last very long. Honey is the extreme opposite. Honey is a preservative. Honey lasts forever. Right? There's no use by date in a honey jar, I think. Because it just lasts, it just never goes bad. Right? When it comes Rosh Hashanah, one of the things we commit ourselves is to both doing and learning. Those are the two parts of the Jewish experience. On the one hand, we commit ourselves to doing, meaning that we will do. We will behave properly, we will do the mitzvahs, even if you don't understand. We committed to the apple, we committed to the nasiv v'nishma, we committed to the commitment, the subservience, the obedience of being committed to behave properly, whether we relate to it, whether we don't like it, whether we do like it, we understand it, we don't understand it, the idea of chukim. In other words, we'll just do it. On the other hand, we understand that commitment alone, as great as it is, because it demonstrates such an incredible commitment and subservience and obedience to Hashem, but we understand that the apple alone is going to go rotten very quickly. It's not sustainable. You have to learn. One has to study. One has to absorb. One has to internalize. And therefore what we do is we commit ourselves to dip the apple into the honey. That we're going to take that commitment of action and spice it up, preserve it with learning, with understanding, with sweetness, so that we start to relate to it, we start to understand it, we start to absorb it. You heard it here first, okay? It's a nice thought. I just thought in...
Because they say honey lasts for generations.
Yeah. So I'm saying it's not even honey. And I've always said, I mean, Jewish learning is something which has kept us, that's really what's kept us throughout the generation. That's what it is, it's learning. So.
The learning. Yeah. If you can remember.
No, you have to learn if you don't remember. Because learning itself is just creates excitement. Yeah. If you don't remember, then you just got to keep learning. You know, you remind me of a good story. There was a great genius called the Rogatchover Goyim. He was known, he was a well-known genius. He was a rav of a town of Dvinsk. And there was another rav there called Or Samech. But the Rogatchover was clearly sort of, you know, high level in a way. So they once told, and the Rogatchover was a person who just learned day and night. Like he hardly slept, hardly ate, hardly anything, he just learned day and night. So they once told the Or Samech about the Rogatchover. He says, you know, your colleague's unbelievable. He knows the whole Talmud by heart. He must have a fantastic memory. He says he doesn't have any memory. He just learned it. Whenever you speak to him, he's just learned the Gemara because he just goes through it every few months. It's not a memory, he just keeps learning. Right? So that's a nice idea. You don't have to always remember things, you have to just keep learning. So, okay. That's part one for today's parsha. Now let's go to part two. We're going to look at something else in the parsha, totally unrelated. As I said, this parsha has many different components. Now, if you go to page 1060, I'm going to share with you an idea. One of the components of this week's parsha is the laws of employment. Right, how you treat workers, workers' rights, employers' rights, employees' rights, always very, one of the things on the top priority list of discussion in Australia, always. Work choices, not work choices. Anyway, whatever, but, huh? Okay, so here we have quite the commitment. In the Torah we find it spoken about different places. Actually, it's very interesting that the commitment of employers to employees and vice versa is actually very, very, very strong in the Torah. Like, for example, the way you pay and the way you treat a worker is incredible. And the commitment, the work ethic that's expected from a worker is also incredible. You know, like there's lots of laws in the Talmud and the Mishnah, that's very different to today, about like company time. Like if you're on company time, the things you're allowed to take off, there's even an expression if you should say the whole of benching. Like obviously the worker's allowed to eat, you know, it's the lunchtime, he's allowed to bench, but maybe not the whole benching because it takes off too much time from the boss, you know, that kind of thing, right? So these laws are very, very detailed and they're spoken about a lot in the Gemara. Part of it is this week's parasha. We're not going to talk about these laws now. I'm going to show you, again, one of the mitzvahs on a whole other level. So let's learn the mitzvah first. The mitzvah says, it's Pasuk Yudalet, page 1060, Pasuk Yudalet, verse 14. Right. So it says like this. First of all, Lo sashoik sachir oni ve'evyon. Do not cheat. Do not do wrong, in other words. With a hired person, a person who you've hired, an employee, basically. Oni ve'evyon, if the person's poor or destitute, in other words, particularly if he's poor or destitute, that means. Me'achecho, amongst your brothers, or me'gerecho, be a convert, asher ba'artzecho, in your land, bisharecho, in your cities. Treat him well, right? Oh, that's the general thing. Then it goes to a specific mitzvah, and it says, be'yoymoi titein scharoi. You need to pay his wages on the day he completes the job. Lo'isovei olav ha'shemesh. The sun may not set and you haven't paid him. Ki onihu, because he's needy. For Elov who knows his nafshi relies on it. But Yikra lecha l'Hashem, and if you don't pay him and he's now hard for cash, he will then call out to God, v'hoyo b'chol chet, and you will have a sin. You will have a transgression. Now this pasuk is talked about twice in the Torah. In Vayikra, in Parashat Kedoshim, and here. With different expression. I'll just explain it to you so you understand how it works. In Parashat Kedoshim it says it differently. The expression is different. It says, you may not wait overnight to pay a worker. Here it says you may not work during the day. You may not wait during the day and the sun shouldn't set. And the answer is very simple. It depends what kind of worker it is. It depends what kind of shift the worker is working. A day shift or a night shift. So the way it works is very simple. When you hire someone per day, in other words, you pay him per the day, right? The halacha is if it's a day worker, he works a day shift, You've got 12 hours till dawn the next morning to pay him. You must pay him before dawn the next morning. Right? Presumably that would be in the middle, in the beginning of the night, I suppose, practically. But technically you've got a whole night. If someone works a night shift and finishes in the morning, then you've got a whole day to pay him. So in Parshas Kedoshim, it's talking about a day worker, and therefore it says he shouldn't wait overnight. Over here, it's talking about a night worker. You shouldn't let the sun set. In other words, you've got all day to pay him, and the sun shouldn't set before you've paid him. Clear? Now, I'm going to share with you an insight that comes from one of the talks of the Rebbe. And it's about this mitzvah, not on a halachic level, it's about this mitzvah, how it works on a spiritual level. And what it does is it highlights quite a deep insight about the whole relationship that we have with God, the things that God does for us, the things that He rewards us with, when He'll reward us, and so on and so forth. But I need to give you three introductions. Okay, it's a bit of a deep idea. Let me give you three introductions. The first is that we have a fundamental concept in Yiddishkeit, that there is a concept of schar, there is a concept of reward. It's one of the 13 principles of faith, that there are consequences of what we're doing, and on the good side of things, there's reward. We do good, there's reward. Now, that doesn't mean that we should do it for the reward. That doesn't mean that we should perform mitzvahs because we're going to get a reward. That's a lower level of keeping a mitzvah. But sometimes it can be an incentive, if that's what gets us going. And the Pirkei Avos does make mention very, very clearly that at least we need to know that that's a concept. The concept exists. That what we do brings ultimately different things. There's Gan Eden, there's Olam Haba, we'll talk about it in a minute, whatever it is, but there's a concept of reward. The Torah mentions it a number of times, and it's apparently such an important principle that it becomes one of the 13 principles of faith. Where the Rambam enumerates the 13 principles of faith, this is one of the principles, that this concept of schar v'onish, there's reward and punishment. That's one concept. The second introduction is that we find many places, one of them being Pirkei Avot, that our relationship with God is like a worker working for an employee. It's like a contractual arrangement. Now we need to explore, and we'll come up with a bit of a different conclusion at the end, what kind of contractual arrangement it is. But it appears that the arrangement that we have with Hashem is like a contract. He's given us this life. We've entered into a contract with Him. I guess the basis of that contract is the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, where we committed, we had this marriage, we had this relationship, we've entered into this contract, we now have a contractual agreement with God that we are supposed to do what we're supposed to do. In other words, we're supposed to learn His Torah and preserve His mitzvahs, and then He's going to do whatever He has to do, which is embedded in the whole reward system, which is built into whatever He's going to reward us with. Okay? So that's the second concept. The third concept is a concept which we've mentioned a number of times, is that we have an idea which is alluded to in the Gemara often, and that is that God keeps His own mitzvahs, right? He's not like a king who commands people to do things which he won't do himself, but he himself observes his own mitzvahs. A very, very famous idea. For example, the Gemara talks about what is written in Hashem's tefillin, on a spiritual level, of course. There's the whole discussion, which I think we've done before, about how could God possibly destroy the Beis HaMikdash. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, you're not allowed to destroy a shul. There's the famous discussion in the Gemara about how Hashem could, it says Hashem was the one to bury Moshe Rabbeinu, but we know also that Hashem is referred to as a Kohen, so how could He bury Moshe Rabbeinu? A Kohen is not allowed to become impure. All these various discussions, there's a famous thing about how Hashem can make it rain on Shabbos, He's watering the plants, He's not keeping Shabbos, all these different discussions, all the different explanations, but where do all these discussions come from? The discussions come from one principle, and the principle is that God is, so to speak, bound by His own mitzvahs. If He told us to keep Shabbos, He has to keep Shabbos. If He told us to put on tefillin, He's got to put on tefillin. And so on and so forth. Clear? So those are the three introductions. Reward, contractual agreement between us and God, and the fact that He keeps His own mitzvahs. If that's the case, the commentaries raise a very, very important problem based on this mitzvah in the parasha. The Gemara says that schar b'hai alma, mitzvah b'hai alma leka, that there's no real reward for a mitzvah in this world. When we talk about the reward for a mitzvah, the Gemara says like this, there's a pasuk which says that God commanded us to do the Torah, hayom la'asotam, today to do it. What does it mean today? So the Gemara says that there's two time frames. There's today, and then there's machar, there's tomorrow. Today refers to this world. Tomorrow refers to what the Gemara calls olam haba, the world to come, which we're not sure what that means, we'll talk about that in a minute. But the world to come, after this world. Right? So the Gemara says that notwithstanding that the Torah does promise us certain good things for mitzvahs if we do them in this world, but that's not the reward for mitzvahs. The reward for mitzvahs is in the next world. Hayom la'asatam, we do mitzvahs in this world, and the reward is in the next world. The true reward for a mitzvah is in the next world. If we really want to understand the depth of the reward for a mitzvah, it's not in this world, it's in the next world. So the Mefarshim say, there's a big halachic problem with that. If that's the case, that God doesn't want to reward us for the mitzvahs that we do in this world, we just said that we're under our contractual agreement with God, we work for Him. If we work for Him, He's in breach of this mitzvah. Right? He's in breach of the mitzvah of paying wages on time. He tells us we've got to pay wages on time, we've got to pay Him on the same day, we don't even have more than 12 hours. So how come He's allowed to withhold, so to speak, the reward, and pay us at a later stage? Right? So this question is dealt with on many levels, and there's many different answers. One answer is, but we'll see why it's insufficient in a second. One answer is like this. You only have to pay a worker on time if he's hired by the day. If I hire someone by the week, right, then I don't have to pay him every day, I pay him at the end of the week. If I hire him for 10 years, if I have a contract, I pay him at the end of the contract. If that was the contract. Now, so they say like this, we need to understand how it works. What is our contractual agreement with God? Our contractual agreement with God is not to do a particular mitzvah at a particular time. That's not the contract. Right? It gives a bit of insight into how the whole relationship, our commitment. The contract is not on the 15th of Tishrei in 5775, which you're about to enter, we should shake lulav, and that's it. And then when we finish that mitzvah, that contract is over. No. We have one big general contract with God when we're born. The contract is to serve Him for the rest of our life, for our whole life. Whatever we do, like the Gemara says, behold, not only mitzvahs, it's whatever we do, we need to give meaning and purpose. Whatever we do in our life, whether it's mitzvahs, directly connected to mitzvahs, whether it's indirectly connected to mitzvahs, whether it's physical, whether it's mundane, whether it's spiritual, whatever it is, needs to be an expression of our commitment to serve God. So we have one long contract. And the one long contract starts when we're born and finishes when we leave this world. And therefore, if it says in the Gemara that God rewards us in this world, and we perform mitzvahs in this world, and the rewarder rewards us in the next world, that's perfectly okay. Because we don't finish the contract until we finish. And so therefore, when we finish, then we finish, then He can reward us. Okay, that's one possible answer. It's a nice answer also in terms of giving us a bit of insight into what our relationship with our commitment is. It's not a one-off thing, not isolated mitzvahs, it's a one general deep commitment. The problem is it doesn't work, this answer, halachically. Why? Because what is the Gemara, now I'm going to share with you just a general thing to know, it's a very interesting thing to know, this dispute, famous dispute. What does it mean when the Talmud says that the mitzvahs are in this world and the reward is in the next world? What's this next world? So we have a famous, sorry? Yeah, what is the next world? So there's different things. There's something we call Gan Eden. Gan Eden is where the souls hang around with after they finish with this world, right? There's a thing. Paradise. But is that what the Gemara means by the world to come? Is the world to come the same thing as the Garden of Eden? Is it the same thing? So we have a dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, about the ultimate reward for mitzvahs. What is the ultimate reward? So the Rambam says that physicality is so limited that that cannot ever be the ultimate reward. And therefore the Rambam maintains that Olam Haba, the world to come, is a spiritual existence. Now we know that we believe in some era that after Mashiach comes there'll be the resurrection of the dead and there'll be some period of peace and utopia, sort of a utopian thing. Says the Rambam, that's great and we believe in that, but that's not the ultimate reward. The ultimate reward is some sort of spiritual existence. Because reward, the ultimate reward can only be reflected in a spiritual existence. That's the view of the Rambam. Now, according to the Rambam, this all fits. Because according to the Rambam, what happens when a person lives this life, his or her soul leaves this existence and goes straight to a spiritual existence where the soul is then able to get the true reward for what he did. The contract isn't over till the end of life. Therefore, the end of life happens, then they start to receive the ultimate reward for the mitzvahs, which is a spiritual existence. The problem is that that's not the view of Nachmanides. That only works according to Maimonides, not according to Nachmanides. Okay? Because Nachmanides, which I'm sharing with you with emphasis, because Nachmanides' view is the view of all the Kabbalists. Right? In Hasidic teachings and in Kabbalistic writings, the accepted view is Nachmanides' view. That no, the ultimate, although there's rewards along the way, incentives along the way, but the ultimate reward for whatever we've done in this world is Olam Haba, the world to come, which the world to come is the world of the resurrection of the dead. Meaning that there will come a time after Mashiach which will be a time not of commitment to doing mitzvahs, but a time to reap the reward, where all these souls will come back into their bodies. We will live a physical life, and yet in that physical life we will receive the ultimate reward. Now, that's hard to understand. How can we get the ultimate reward in a finite physical world? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But that's what he says. He says the ultimate reward will be the ultimate connection to God, and the ultimate reward will be when Tchias HaMeisim happens, when the resurrection of the dead happens. Okay? Which then comes back and creates the problem. It's fine to say that when I live my life, my contract's not over till I leave this world. The problem is the reward's not happening when I leave this world. According to Nachmanides, the mitzvahs that I do in this world is not going to be ultimately rewarded when I leave this world. The reward is only going to happen, right? So, let's say someone that lived three generations ago, right? My great grandfather still, or my great grandmother still, haven't received the ultimate reward. Why? Because their ultimate reward for the mitzvahs that they have done is going to take place when Mashiach comes. Post Mashiach, there will be this era of Tchias HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, which then they will come back and join this beautiful period called Olam Haba, and that's the time we're all going to get rewarded. Which means they haven't received the reward. They finished the contract, but they haven't received the reward. So we get back to this halachic problem, the halachic analysis problem. How's God performing this mitzvah? He's not paying on time. Okay? So the Rebbe explains like this. He says, no, it doesn't work like that. Because let's understand the contractual agreement. What is our contract? When we say that when we're born, you see, the purpose of the discussion is not just a cute halachic analysis on God keeping his mitzvah. We're not checking up on God yet to see if he's keeping up his mitzvah or not, right? I mean, it's a nice discussion, but it's about giving insight into what our purpose and mission is. That's really what it's about, right? He says, we need to understand what actually is our contractual agreement with God. So we said before that the contractual agreement is that we're born to serve God. Okay? So it's one long contract. So it's not day, it's not by month, it's not by week, it's not by year, it's a whole lifetime. But let's take it a step further. What is that contract? What do we mean to serve? What are we doing by serving it? What are we supposed to do in this world? So we've talked about this concept of Dira B'Tachtonim, making this world a dwelling place for God. Right? The Midrash says, and this is one of the things that is brought in Hasidic teachings at great length, that what was the purpose of creation? The purpose of creation was that God desired, for whatever reason, we don't know, but he desired, to have a place which is called Tachtonim. It's a low place, meaning low in level. It's a place that God is not there, obviously, in obvious way, in other words. He's not felt. It's a place of darkness. It's a place of finiteness. It's a place which is the lowest level that can possibly exist. And that's where God chose, that's where he wants to live. He wants to live. Right? And that's our purpose. Our purpose is to reveal God in this lowly existence. How do we reveal God in this lowly existence? So what happens is, it's actually an accumulative job, it's an accumulative contract of all generations. Because what happens is like this. The way it works is, when we live a physical life, we live a physical routine, we work in the physical world, we take physical objects like a candle or a piece of leather, and we use it to serve God, we elevate it. We bring God into the physicality. Right? We bring God into our workday. We bring God into the table if we're using it for a mitzvah. We have a Shabbos table. You know, we have a concept, you know, that we have a thing whenever we eat, we have salt on the table. Why do we have salt on the table? Because when they used to bring sacrifices on the altar in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, there was always salt with every sacrifice. When we eat at a table, the Shulchan Aruch says our table is an altar. What does it mean, a table is an altar? Eating is an experience where we can elevate, where we can bring holiness into it. Everything that we do, every physical thing we do, mitzvahs and non-directly related mitzvahs are all things where we can introduce, bring God to live here. We bring more and more, we bring God to live here. Now, when you live somewhere, there's two parts to living in a home, right? One is that you exist there. And secondly, you exist there in an obvious way, right? If I walk, where's a person most revealed? Where's a person most expressed? In their own home, right? That's where a person is least reserved. So, if God wanted to make a dirabat, he wanted us to make a dwelling place, he wanted us to make a home for him in this world, It's not just about bringing him here. It's not just about drawing godliness into the world. It's about revealing him in the world. Right? So how does it actually work? For now, we each have a little piece of physical world that we need to bring God into. Right? We each have our own little part in the world. But for now, how's it happening? Like we take the piece of leather, we make it into tefillin. None of us see God there. We might make a bracha before we eat, or eat kosher, or turn our Shabbos table into a spiritual existence, etc. But we might feel something, but we don't. God hasn't yet become completely revealed there. How does it work? Right? So it works like this. It's actually in two stages. That job of dirab tachtanim, of bringing God into the world, of making a home, actually will not be completed. I mean, now we're going Nachmanides' route. Is actually not going to be completed until everything is finished. Why? Because what is a derivative? What does it mean to make a dwelling place for God in the low world? You need two things for that. You need a low world, and you need to make a home for Him. The point was to bring Him into a world where He's not obvious. If every time we did a mitzvah, He would suddenly be obvious, then it wouldn't be a low existence anymore. It wouldn't be able to do the job. So for now, God says, bring me in, but you're not going to see it. Because the whole idea is to bring light into darkness, to reveal Him where He's not obvious. And it's been accumulative. We've been doing this for generations. Every time we take another piece of physical thing, we make a mitzvah out of it. Every time in fact, it says, for example, it's like a perspective a person has to have. Like, you know, when you, we often talk about this in our family, we go on holiday. Like, you know, if you go on holiday in like a remote place, you know, and you land up in some, what's it called in South Africa? Dorothy. How do you call it in like a... in the moonies. Some shtetl, some forest, right? And you know, like we've often had this thing, you know, we get up in the morning, like, you know, daven shacharis before we start the day. We wonder, so I wonder the last time someone davened here, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And the Baal Shem Tov says that's how it works. That's the perspective you have to have. It could be that's, you think you went there for a holiday. The truth is you went there because there's a job to do there. It could be that little corner needs to be elevated. There's like some bracha that needs to be made there, or some verse of Tillim, or you need to learn the Parsha there, whatever the case is. It's a perspective. Every experience we have, every place we go to, we need to have that experience. So what can I do? Maybe this is a part of the world that hasn't yet been elevated yet, or it's part of the experience that hasn't been done yet, whatever the case is, right? So, which is, by the way, the depth of Golus. That's a depth of exile. That's why, ultimately, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and we got scattered in the whole world. Because we need to make this dwelling place for Hashem in the entire world, and until every corner is finished, we haven't done the job. When the last bit is done, and we never know what the last bit is, then Mashiach will come. And then Mashiach will come, then there'll be Tchias HaMeis, there'll be the resurrection of the dead, and suddenly then, God will reveal Himself. But when God reveals Himself in the world of the resurrection of the dead, the world of Olam Haba, the world to come, according to the word that Ramban explains it, it's not going to be a new thing. He's just going to turn on the light. In other words, then all of a sudden we'll see everything that we've done for the last thousands of years. We do it now. It's like, to give you an analogy, whenever we do a mitzvah now, it's like making a deposit in the bank. We just can't cash it yet. When the right amount is there, the God says, okay, the account is open, you can now have it. Because then the job of making a dwelling place for Hashem in this world would have been completely completed. Which then leads us to two incredible things. First of all, it answers the question. Why? Because not only are we not on a day job or a week job, we're not on a life job either. We're on an accumulative, collective contract here. My contract, or your contract, or my great-grandfather's contract, or Moshe Rabbeinu's contract is all the same contract. And that contract doesn't finish until the moment that it's finished. And therefore God is not in violation of not rewarding us completely and perfectly until Tchias HaMeisim, because until the moment of Tchias HaMeisim, until the moment of Olam Haba, the contract's not over. Because it's not that it's my whole life is one contract, our whole Jewish existence is one contract. And therefore, it's a contract to do what? Not just to do mitzvahs or to serve Him in my lifetime, it's a contract to create this home. This home will only be completed when He lives in the home, meaning He's revealed in the home. But He's only going to be revealed in the home when the home is complete. And the home is only complete when accumulatively we are finished with the job. We've done every mitzvah and elevated every nook and cranny of the world that we have to. Which, by the way, answers a very, very important question. People often ask the question, you know, the world is in bad spiritual shape today. How come we praying for Mashiach, what, He should come to this world? He didn't come to my great-grandfather's world, which is a much better world, the Moshe Rabbeinu's world. Why should He come to our world? The answer is no. The answer is, what they did, they did. Whatever they elevated, they elevated. The world might look like a really, really immoral world. It might be a beautiful dish with a very thin layer of dirt underneath. You just can't see it. But the truth is, it's almost done. The barrel is almost full. The world actually is filled with holiness. We just need a little few more little things, obviously, for it to happen. But actually, whatever hasn't been done accumulatively with the Torah mitzvahs of all the generations has had its effect, just hasn't been revealed. When the final touches of the home is complete, then the contract is over, and then God is revealed, and then their ultimate reward will happen. Now, what is that reward? What does it mean? What's God going to give us? A good piece of steak he's going to give us. What exactly is he going to give us in that Olam Haba to reward us? What is the reward? Number one. And number two, what is Nachmanides? In other words, yes, we understand the purpose is for God to live in the physical world, but isn't the Rambam, you know, have a point? How can there possibly be a reward in the physical world? Well, the physical world is finite. Number two. And number three, having understood this whole idea, we need to understand something else. The ultimate reward is Olam Haba, we understand that, and God is not in breach of any halacha because the contract's not totally over till then. But if that's the case, where does the other rewards fit into it? The God gives us rewards in the Torah. He gives us physical rewards. He says, if we listen to his mitzvah, he'll give us rain, he'll give us peace, he'll give us this, he'll give us that. Where do they come into the whole concept? Where do they fit into the whole idea? What obligation does God have to give us reward in the meantime if we don't finish the contract? Or why is he paying us? Why is he then, if the whole relationship is one of an employer and employee, so why is he paying us now then? He shouldn't give us anything now. He's not obligated to give us anything now. Does he have any obligation now halachically? What's the story? The story is as follows. What is the reward that's going to happen? What actually is that reward? The reward is like this. Up until the final moment of Olam Haba, any reward that God gives us is the reward of recreation. In other words, there's the creation and the creator. It's the reward in our world. We should have rain. We should have physical things. Even the spiritual rewards that souls having an Eden, they'll have a greater insight in Torah. They'll enjoy the revelation of godliness, etc., etc. Right? But Chassidus explains that the reward that will happen when Olam Haba happens is a whole different reward. Suddenly, God will reveal to us the amazing pleasure that He has in the fact that He lives in the physical world. We don't know what that pleasure is. We don't know why it is. We don't know what God gets out of it, but it's important to Him. Because that's why He created the world. And that's why He gave us the Torah. God has this, what we call this nachas ruach, this tremendous pleasure. Whatever pleasure means in God's context, which you don't really understand what that means in His level. But whatever He gets, whatever this infinite, tremendous purpose that He gets from living in a world of darkness, from being revealed where He's not obvious, is something that's in His world, not our world. But the ultimate reward will be is that when He reveals Himself and that experience happens, we will suddenly appreciate what He's getting out of it. Because He will be so revealed that the reward will be for us to enjoy, so to speak, to put it in simple terms, to enjoy what He enjoys. Which is absolutely incredible. In other words, because we can say the words, but actually we have no idea what we're talking about. Because we can talk about getting a finite reward, we can talk about getting an infinite reward, but the infinite reward and finite reward is still in our terms, in our frame of reference. It can be beyond our finiteness, or it can be within our finiteness. Okay. But if talking about that, what's going to happen then is that God will be revealed in the physical world, and the concept of making a dwelling place for Hashem will ultimately be realized, and will mean so much to God, and suddenly we will see things from His world, from His frame of reference, that's the ultimate infinity. We don't even understand what that means. We can't even define it. But that's what's going to be revealed when Olam Haba has. In other words, what He gets out of it and what we get out of it, ultimately is going to be the same thing. It's not that He says, can you do a job for me and then I'll pay you. But like, can you build me a house and I'll give you $100,000. So you get the $100,000, I get the house. No, it's actually different. When God says, do the mitzvahs and make a derubat achtoinim, you know what it says? It says, ultimately, what's the reward of a mitzvah? It says, schar mitzvah mitzvah. The reward for a mitzvah is the mitzvah. Meaning, because the ultimate, there are rewards along the way, but the ultimate reward is that whatever He gets out of it, we're going to get out of it. Whatever He gets out of it is the ultimate of infinity, and that's going to be our reward. Ah, says the Rebbe, if that's the case, oops, we're right. If that's the case, so now the whole contract relationship is a different relationship. Why? Because the whole contract relationship is not of a worker and it's not an employee and an employer. It's a partnership. And it's a partnership which is spoken about in Halacha. It's called the sleeping partnership. And the Rambam that he quotes to describe this partnership is if it's based on the Gemara. The Gemara says, if someone says, if I come to you and say, listen, can you do me a favor? I want to enter into a partnership business with you. I have eggs that have just been laid. But I don't know if I want you to breed them, to put them on the chickens, to look after them, and then to grow the chickens. Right? So you don't have the capital. I'm putting in the capital. I'm giving it to you. Right? But I want you now to look after these eggs and these chickens that will hatch from the eggs, etc. for a year or two. And at the end, we're going to sell them. And it's a partnership because I'm not going to pay you. But the reward is we're going to split the profits. Right? It's a partnership. So says the Rebbe, that same sort of contract. In other words, God's not saying, he's not saying, can you do me a favor and then I'll reward you with something that you'll appreciate. No. Can you work for me and we'll conceptually, symbolically split the profits? In other words, my reward and your reward will be exactly the same. What I get out of it, ultimately you will appreciate. Also, that'll be the ultimate reward. Okay, so that's fine. That's when the ultimate reward comes then, because until then we're not ready for that reward. When the world reaches its completion, we're ready. But says the Rebbe, there's a very interesting halacha. The halacha is that if you come and you enter into a partnership like that, like a sleeping partnership, I'm the sleeping partner and you're the active partner. And I say, listen, I'm putting in the capital, I'm not going to pay you for this work, but we're going to split the profit. Right? So you're not a worker, you're a partner. I'm putting in the money, but you're doing the work. That's the partnership, and the profits will split. The halacha is that you can tell me, listen, that's fine. You'll work for me for 2 years raising these chickens and these eggs, but how am I going to live for 2 years without cash? You're going to have to at least do something in the meantime that I can get there. You're not going to pay me, but you have to at least prop me up so that support me in the meantime for my bare necessities, at least that I'm comfortable enough to be able to do the job. If you don't give me a resource for the job, I can't live without cash. So therefore, give me the job, at least support me. I understand it's not a payment for the job, it's not a salary, but you've got to support me until I get there in order to achieve the job. And the Gemara says that is, it's an obligation of the partner. So if I put in the capital, I say, you have to raise chickens and we'll split the profit, I still have to pay you in the meantime, not as a salary, but at least so you support it until you get there. So the Rebbe, that's why God is still under obligation to give us the other rewards as well. The rewards is that when we commit to Torah and Mitzvahs, as the Rambam says, God has got to give us the things he talks about in the Chumash, like the rain and the peace and all that. Why? He's halachically obligated. Why is he halachically obligated? Because now we understand the whole thing to be a partnership. If we're a partnership where the profits are going to be split in Alam Abba, where we'll appreciate his reward, our reward will all be the same reward, so to speak. But in the meantime, he's got to get us there. We can't do it without any resources. So therefore, he's got to give us the right things. And therefore, that's kind of the same. He ties it in at the end of that talk to this time of the year. He says, we come to Rosh Hashanah, we kind of have to make a bargain with God. I say, listen, we're recommitting during this year. But we're recommitting. Every Jew comes to Rosh Hashanah, we have to recommit a little bit. We have to commit to doing better than we've done in the past year. But we also are able to say, God, listen, we're recommitting because we're reaffirming, we're recommitting to this partnership. But at the same time, you also have to recommit to your obligations. I'm recommitting to the partnership. Your obligations is you have to give us a good and sweet year so that we can learn Torah properly, so that we can do the mitzvahs properly, so that we have the resources to serve you properly, so that we can work towards finishing the job, getting to the ultimate contractual conclusion, which is Alam Abba, and making that dwelling place for you in this world.